I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In her continuing and excellent series, Paying Till It Hurts, in the New York Times, Elizabeth Rosenthal wrote last week, in operating rooms and on hospital wards across the country, physicians and other health providers typically help one another in patient care. But in an increasingly common practice that some medical experts call drive-by doctoring, assistants, consultants, and other hospital employees are charging patients or their insurers hefty fees. The practice increases revenue for physicians and other healthcare workers at a time when insurers are cutting down reimbursement for many services. Elizabeth Rosenthal keeps writing her series Paying Till It Hurts in the Times, and we'll be speaking with her this hour about her latest article. It was... After surgery, $117,000 bill from doctor he never saw. Patients wake up to huge charges they didn't expect and had no choice in. Elizabeth has been with us many times before. She's a trained medical doctor. She has been producing this series for quite some time. She also was the international environment correspondent for the New York Times. She was in the Beijing Bureau for quite some time, breaking landmark stories on health in China, the spread of HIV, the demise of the rural healthcare system, and efforts to market patented U.S. drugs in China. And she's been producing this terrific healthcare cost series. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello again, Elizabeth.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, great article again. I mean, this one is just, are you serious? You got a lot of nerve, $117,000 bill from a doctor that the patient never saw. This is really interesting, these huge charges. I don't think most people know that this is happening.
Well, certainly Peter Dreyer, who was the main person in the story, he didn't realize this was happening. And he, once again, the people I focus on these articles, they are good medical consumers who tried to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he met his surgeon, who he liked. He had a good sense of how his insurance would cover the hospital, the anesthesiologist, his surgeon. He had all of those discussions that we tell patients to have in advance. And then when he starts getting bills, he sees that there was another surgeon in the room who billed way more than the primary surgeon got, and he was pretty pissed about that.
Yeah, is it normal to have assistant surgeons, and for this kind of surgery particularly?
Well, in many surgeries it is, and I think most people would say that for this kind of surgery, he had spinal surgery on his neck, there's often a second set of skilled hands needed. Now, those might be in another case if you were to teaching hospital a resident, or it could be a trained physician assistant or a trained neurosurgical tech. So, but and some doctor, in fairness, might want to call in another surgeon. I think the question in this particular case is not whether it was a good idea to have a second set of hands in the room, but was that worth $117,000? And if someone was going to charge for being a second person in the room, shouldn't the patient have a chance to consent to that first, especially since the second surgeon was out of Peter Dreyer's insurance network? So that was a very, very big bill that he saw.
Yeah. And what about the doctor who was doing the primary surgery? Did he or she not have say-so as to who else might be in the room? Was cost a consideration for that doctor?
Well, he did have a choice of who was in the room. I don't know that he had any sense of what his assistant surgeon was billing. I mean, there's a long-standing tradition in medicine of doctors helping each other out with care. And that's a good thing, right? We want that kind of collaborative process. I think what's happened more and more, though, is those people who were called in to help are billing separately. And often the primary doctor, when he says or she says, hey, maybe we should have a dermatologist look at this if you're in the hospital, has no idea what that person is going to be billing or what they're going to be charging. So, you know, it's yet another example of how hard it is to get good disclosure of costs ahead of time until you see that bill. You know, if that primary surgeon knew that this assistant was going to be charging $117,000, would he have called in someone else? That's a good question. I mean, I would.
Right. And I thought it was interesting that the doctor in question here did not respond to your request to speak to him. So yeah. He thought that it was best that he not talk about why that bill was $117,000.
Right. And, you know, what I was told by several insurance lawyers and people who do health care fraud was that, you know, this particular doctor, there are other doctors doing worse. And indeed, you know, one of the other patients told me who had a different kind of spinal surgery, her complaint was that two plastic surgeons were called in to sew up the wound after the surgery and charged $269,000.
Wow.
So, I mean, the size of some of these bills is pretty staggering. And I guess I would say, you know, it's terrible whether it's $269,000 or $117,000 or $5,000, you know, which that's a lot of money for a patient to get hit with when they weren't expecting it. People kind of budget for these things in advance. And when you renovate a house or, you know, go to a restaurant or you have a sense of what things are going to cost you in advance. But in healthcare, that's just not the case.
Right. And the doctor, I guess, who performed the primary surgery was a little upset about this.
Yeah, well, he was. You know, he had arranged with Peter Dreyer because Peter had talked to him ahead of time, and they said, we'll work with your insurance company to settle on a rate that we can live with.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up settling on $6,200 was his total payment. And, of course, when he heard that the other surgeon got $117,000,
right.
You know, I guess there's a certain degree of, wait a second, why do I get this low rate? And his office asked Peter to try and increase the payment from the insurer. And Peter Dreyer, who was, as I said, he was a really great, active, engaged patient. He tried to troubleshoot this. He felt his primary surgeon was somewhat underpaid. But in the end, you know, the system doesn't let you troubleshoot your own care even.
You talk about the special things that may happen or not so special things that may happen when you are admitted as an emergency admission.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are, you obviously have people in doctors in your insurance network, and you try and stay within that insurance network if you're trying to be cost conscious. And basically, if someone comes in as an emergency admission, it's easier for doctors who are outside the network to treat you. Now, that can be a good thing. Maybe the place you go doesn't have a doctor who has the skill you need.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't, you know, in the case of an emergency, you don't want to be kind of limited to your network. On the other hand, what we saw in researching this article was that emergency admission designation is often used to get around efforts by insurers to reasonably make sure that people are getting cost-effective care. So, and you know, if you say back surgery is rarely an emergency, but we see a lot of back surgery admissions coming in through the emergency room because that gets around all of the in-network charges. People can charge out of network.
And what was this story of this company coming in right before the person is supposed to, Mark Sullivan, his name, to go in for surgery? They didn't accept Blue Cross plans, which is what he had, so he would be required to pay the bill himself? They're telling him this before the operation?
Yeah, you know, we actually, if you look at it, we had about, I think, 1,100 responses to this story, where we asked people to tell us about experiences they'd had with surprise charging, and this came up a lot. During neurosurgery, you need, and I don't think this is optional, you generally need neurologic monitoring. It's to make sure that those delicate nerves that are within your spine don't get damaged during the surgery. What we discovered is that many of the companies that do neuromonitoring aren't in insurance networks. many are in no insurance network. So Peter Dreyer, and we heard this from other patients as well, went into the operating room, and as he's being wheeled in, he's asked to sign a consent form saying, we regret to inform you that your insurer will not cover monitoring during this surgery, so you're going to have to pay out of pocket. I mean, first of all, it's not like at that point or at any point you can say, oh, it's okay,
yeah,
I just don't want
right.
the monitoring.
Right, exactly.
And it's not even like at that point it's a real consent form, right? You're on your way into the OR. And so we had other patients who complained that they got this bill even after the surgery, you know, that they suddenly saw a $5,000 bill for neurologic monitoring, and they called their insurer and called the hospital and said, wait, what's this? And they said, oh, you know, and all that pile of forms you signed when you were admitted to the hospital, there was a box you initialed saying that you understand that some services may not be covered by your insurance. But I don't think any of us, when we initial that box, think it's as something as essential as monitoring during surgery.
Absolutely. So how common is this practice? You talk about hospitals encouraging extra visits for all kinds of things. I think that many of us who are in the hospital find sometimes there are a whole host of doctors who are checking in on us, and, you know, you're kind of in a fog. How are you doing? I'm all right. And then they're gone, and you can have all kinds of these people. I think you quote a Yale cardiac surgeon who says you can cut fees, but institutions find ways to make money back. So do many of them encourage extra visits to make more money?
Well, I think, you know, it's very hard to say what's driven by institutions and what's driven by individual providers. And there is a legal aspect to this as well. But I think whether they actively encourage it and say, hey, go drop in on these patients and sign, you know, write a little consult note in the chart, or whether they just tolerate private physicians going in and doing it, which we saw in many of these cases, to the patient, there's little difference. You end up having that charge, and they're both really, really difficult because, as you said, you're lying there, and, you know, people come in and say, oh, look, your blood pressure's a little high. Well, who was that? Is that someone who's going to bill me? Who asked that person to come? Often what we found is that no one asked that person to come. That person was just kind of wandering around looking for consults. So I think hospitals, whether they encourage it or whether they just fail to curb the practice, need to really address this because it's terribly unfair to patients. And some patients who've had this experience described in our comments again, having a spouse sit by the bedside basically interrogating everyone who walks into the room, you know, who sent you? Why are you here?
Right.
If you walk me to the bathroom, are you billing for that service? Because if you are, I don't want it. And it's kind of sad that patients have to be, I mean, I'm all for active patients, but that when you're sick, you have to be on your guard all the time in this way, I think is a pretty sad state of affairs.
So tell us, Elizabeth, about this New York State law taking effect in March, looking at some aspects of what you wrote about.
Yeah, some states are starting to deal with this, and New York has what I think is a pretty good law coming into effect next March. Basically, what it says is that in cases where you had no choice or where it was an emergency, you will not be responsible for charges beyond what you would have paid within the confines of your plan. Mm. So basically, the law guards against the most kind of egregious of these bills, which are the big out-of-network bills where you didn't consent to them. So basically, it means that patients will only be responsible for what is within their approved by their insurance plan. So it's certainly a start, but it doesn't prevent a lot of the kind of drive-by within network doctoring that we do see anyway. You know, it would not prevent, for example, which we heard about a lot, a physical therapist coming into your hospital room and walking you to the bathroom and then billing $400 to your insurer. You would be protected as a patient from that charge. But, you know, as we've said before in some of these shows, whether you're paying directly or whether your insurer is paying, I mean, it's better if it's your insurer, I guess, but in the end, we all pay because our premiums
right.
and deductibles go up every year.
Elizabeth Rosenthal is our guest this hour, and her latest in a terrific series in the New York Times was last Sunday. The series is Paying Till It Hurts, and this particular front page story looks at, after surgery, a $117,000 bill from doctor he never saw, huge charges that you don't expect and you had no choice in, how widespread they are, how much drive-by doctoring is involved, and it all adds to the cost of health care, sometimes out of your pocket or out of an insurer's pocket. It still adds to the cost of health care, huge cost in this country. We have a lot of phone calls coming in, and we'll start taking them in a moment. Here's the number for you to speak with Elizabeth, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Tomorrow during this time period, Karen Abbott will join us to talk about her book. It's getting a lot of attention, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, the captivating true story of four women who risked all during the Civil War to become spies. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for Elizabeth Rosenthal, and we start with Linda in Madison. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been an operating room nurse for over 25 years and recently retired. And I wanted to say, first of all, that I certainly appreciate the show and have been following your series, Dr. Rosenthal, on a variety of subjects and love what you're doing. I certainly know about the consults that happen in an operating room. Sometimes they are for a rather new practitioner in a group of surgeons, that someone may just come in and double check, or they may ask their senior associate to come in and do that. It also happens with, as you say, with emergency situations where they may be called in, and I know I've called when they hadn't even had a chance to ask that. I said, we need somebody in here right away. So that has happened. I certainly agree with what you're saying about some of the people who just peek in. I used to see it earlier in my practice where some of these older docs that were about ready to retire, they just stopped in for a visit, and I wonder, you know, we're supposed to be here. There is patient confidentiality. You really probably shouldn't be here. And perhaps that was happening, but I just wanted to share that.
Thank you, Linda. Elizabeth.
Yeah, what we do know, and it's what we do know, New York State has a pretty good database of surgeries, and several of the insurers were looked through their records as well. These two doctors do operate together a fair amount in this role, where one is the operator, the same one is the primary surgeon, and the second one assists him a fair amount with this kind of surgery. So is that a good thing? If they operate well together, it may be fine. I think the question is not with, to me, the primary question is not whether doctors should operate together on this kind of surgery, which they often do, but what's a reasonable bill? I should say that Medicare for assistant surgeons pays 16% of the primary surgeon's fee. So, you know, that gives you a kind of benchmark. Now, I know people will say, well, everyone knows Medicare fees are low. And yes, that's true. But the proportion, I think, still holds, you know, and 16% of a primary surgeon's fee in this case would be, I think, about $1,000. So quite a bit less than what was billed and received.
Well, you also write about maybe other surgeries that may not be quite as delicate, where you really don't need a co-surgeon with
right.
you. You could use an assistant. You could use a resident. How often
right.
are these doctors being called in when it's not necessary?
Well, I don't think we have a good sense of that is part of the problem. You know, there's a lot in our healthcare system that we don't know, and people find out about it on their individual bills. You know, there was someone in the article who had an eye biopsy, a needle eye biopsy, where two ophthalmologists were billing $10,000 each. Yeah. Now, certainly for that, it's not needed. And so I guess the question is, you know, how do we track these things better, too? Because what happens is, you know, and the insurers will say, too, well, you know, we don't know this is happening until we get the bill. So we know it's happening in a lot of individual cases, but we don't know, you know, is it happening? What's being charged in those cases? Why is it happening? There's just not a lot of great information out there on this practice, but it's definitely going up. And again, the billing for it is definitely going up. And that, to me, is the real heart of the issue.
Thank you, Linda. Rick in Green Bay. Hi.
Hi, Rick. Excuse me. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Rick.
Pleasure listening to you and your guests today. I had the misfortune this year of having a minor stroke and then a hernia surgery, and I can certainly relate to the guest's point of getting billings from doctors that I didn't know were there, and in some cases even multiple billings from the same doctor. Two things that occurred to me, and I'd like to have your guest address. One, as I'm listening to you, I'm wondering if these multiple people aren't. Let me start with the second point. Second point is that on my insurance, one of the first things I see is this negotiated discount, which takes off, in some cases, much more than 50% of what the original billing had been. Getting back to the first point, then, do you think this could be a strategy on the part of the physicians to get back to something closer to 100% of what their intended billings were?
Yes, is the very short answer. I think part of what we're seeing here, and perhaps a big part of what we're seeing here, is patients are caught in the middle of a struggle between providers and insurers. So insurers, as we all know, have been cutting down reimbursement rates to many physicians and surgeons. The physicians and surgeons aren't happy about that, of course, and so they look for ways to kind of compensate for that reduction in payment. But, you know, who's caught in the middle? I would be fine with this if the negotiation was just between the providers and the insurers, but who's caught in the middle are the patients who suddenly are getting these bills for out-of-network charges for, you know, again, it doesn't matter really. I've heard them for $500 and, as you saw, $117,000. So all I know is I don't know who's right or wrong or where the right price payment level is, but I know that physicians who care about their patients shouldn't want their patients stuck with that.
Yeah, I appreciate your response.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for your call. Debbie in central Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The other problem, one of the many problems I see, is the billing system. So you have a surgery, and then you get multiple bills. Everything is billed separately. So I, being tend to be a good consumer, would compare the bills to my estimated benefit from my insurance company. And if you don't know what the codes mean, you can't match up. You can't figure out who's paying what. I called my insurance company at one of the last surgeries I had and said, I don't know what this code is. And she said, what this is saying is that your last surgery, two anesthesiologists billed the same code for the same surgery, and we're not going to pay for both of them.
Oh.
And I would have no idea that that's what that code was,
right,
or, you know, that the codes meant that. So I would end up paying, if I hadn't been diligent, I would have ended up paying out of pocket for something that I didn't know happened and shouldn't have happened.
Right. No, it shouldn't. So, Elizabeth.
Yeah, and I think we as patients and consumers and our legislators, if they will help us on this, really need to demand more patient-friendly billing. You know, I trained as a physician, and I look at every patient who's in the series. I insist on seeing their bills, but a lot of them are really, really hard for me to decode, to figure out what was being billed for. And you frequently see this, two people billing for the same thing. Well, is that what we're talking about, drive-by doctoring, where they were assisting each other? Maybe. Both of the surgeons on this particular surgery, Peter Dreyer's surgery, billed the same codes. So is that okay? Is that not okay? So I think if we want consumers to look at their bills, then we have to have them in a form that's at least somewhat consumer friendly. And I'll say, even the bills that I've seen that endeavor to not just use codes, they have things like Mr. Sullivan's bill had miscellaneous charges, $7,300. I mean, what do you do with that? Would that be okay in any other part of our lives? Not at all.
Yeah.
So I think there's certainly a lot of room for easy improvement here.
Well, what about the insurers? When they saw that code, two anesthesiologists giving the same code and maybe only one was needed, would they say, ooh, something looks suspect here, let's get to the bottom of it?
Are you asking me or the patient?
I'm asking you.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes they would. Yeah, they would. What they would probably do is just deny one patient a payment and say it's a duplicate. Now, if there were two anesthesiologists who were both there, who were both trying to bill, and the payment was denied, they would likely go after the patient and say, sorry, your insurance denied this, but we thought it was necessary, so you have to pay.
Right.
So, you know, it leaves patients very, very vulnerable. And I think one thing that we have to kind of get beyond, in Peter Dreyer's case, the thing that bothered him most was he went to his insurer and said, you know, look, I didn't know the second surgeon was going to be there. I never met the guy. I don't think I should be responsible for paying this. And his insurer, Blue Cross Blue Shield insurer, said, you're right. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
And then they wrote the surgeon a check. They paid the whole $117,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I called the insurer to say, why would you do this? You know this is, their answer, which, again, is comprehensible if you just look at it from their perspective, is, look, we didn't have a contract with this guy. We don't know if he was necessary. It costs so much to investigate each individual case and then litigate it if we think they're wrong and we're right, that it's just not worth the trouble to do it on a case-by-case basis.
Well, I think things are changing because he's in a front-page story on the New York Times, don't you think?
Well, I hope so, and I certainly hope people will be asking. I've already heard from colleagues here who've gone in for little medical procedures, and the doctors have said, don't worry, there's no assistant in the room. So, and I think that's good for us to have our antenna up, and for the community of surgeons and physicians and other providers.
Absolutely.
To know that people are watching, that you can't just submit bills and expect people won't notice anymore.
Yeah. Elizabeth Rosenthal, our guest, our phone number, some lines are open now. They've been crowded. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Tom in Central Wisconsin, hi.
Hi. Well, a quick message, and that is, I believe that the root cause of this problem is our fee-for-service system, and that's what we need to talk about. And specifically, I would love to hear your guest, Dr. Rosenthal, commenting on political forces that benefit from the fee-for-service, as well as, you know, the specialists, procedural specialists, who probably benefit financially from the fee-for-service system. And how could we change the system to a more meaningful one, bundled, capitated, managed, et cetera? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, I think this is a very important point, and I would note that Commission on Physician Payment Reform last year, which was, I think the honorary chairman was Senator Bill Frist, a Republican, and many Democrats were also on that committee, said that the United States had to get away from fee-for-service medicine. That's medicine where physicians are paid and providers are paid for each thing they do. How we do that is a political question. Mm-hmm. You know, I know there, and you know, I'm a reporter. I'm not the one who says this is the answer, and I think there are many answers. Of course, there are those who would say, oh, we need a national health system where we have a single payer. That certainly is one way to do it, but there are plenty of ways within a market-based system to do it. And one of them the caller mentioned, which is gaining a good deal of traction, is bundled care. So if we said to a hospital, okay, for a cervical spine operation like the one Peter Dreyer had, you're going to get, say, I'm just picking a number out of my hat, you know, $50,000, and you guys figure out how you're going to split it up, but that's what you're getting. That would make a big difference, because then the hospital, the doctor, the anesthesiologist, the surgeon, they'd all have to work out what was reasonable. And there's, you know, there are many ways, again, to take the next step to get to this kind of bundled care. Medicare actually does it for surgery, for the hospital part of surgery, though not for the surgeon's fees. But there could be completely bundled care. Some companies, some of the big buyers of health care, like Safeway, and I believe it's the California Public Employees Service Fund, CalPERS, basically what they're saying is for elective procedures like a hip replacement or a colonoscopy, they're saying this is the amount we'll pay for it. And providers, you come to us and meet that amount. And they're not picking an unreasonably low amount. The way they set the amounts is by looking at the range they see from their employees over the course of a year. And they say, where in that range do we think we need to be to provide good care? And that's what they'll pay. And if patients want to go to a higher cost provider, they pay the difference. But guess what they find is that all the hospitals in California, when they say this, make it happen with that reference price. So I think there are ways to do it, but how we get from here to there, and there are many, many, as you can imagine, powerful business interests, hospitals,
right,
physician groups, many of the medical societies now have their own super PACs who, you know, have fought against this idea.
Let's go next to Grace in Wisconsin. Hi, Grace.
Hi. I was just going to make the point that where possible, patients may also request a pre-authorization in advance of their hospital operation, or whenever they're getting a major service. It is advisable, insurers advise it, don't they, that they should request a pre-authorization from their insurer. And in that way, they could get a breakdown of their benefits and charges in advance from the insurer. And at least that helps. I know I've done that. Thank you.
Thank you, Grace.
Sure. Yeah, and I think getting pre-authorization is a good idea. Peter Dreyer actually got pre-authorization, but I think the problem that we're seeing, and what I was particularly concerned about in this story, is you have pre-authorization for the services you know about, but it's hard to get pre-authorization for the services you don't know about, and that's where all of these, what we refer to as drive-by doctors come in. They were services that weren't anticipated, and you have very little clout either with your insurer or with the physician to get a better rate once it's already happened.
Mm-hmm. Let's move. We can go back to where we were, but let's move to a new area for a moment. You also, I'm always interested in these international comparisons. You write about how the U.S. has more neurosurgeons per capita than almost any other developed country, competing with orthopedists for spinal surgery. Why is that? Why is that?
Well, you know, we're not as wildly out of line in this as we are with many other things. We have Japan does have more neurosurgeons than we do. We have about, I think, 50% more than most European countries. And I think there are parts of the United States where you'll find too few neurosurgeons. I think the New York market, from what we've seen, is relatively flush with both neurosurgeons and orthopedists who want to do spine surgery.
Mm.
It's a relatively lucrative part of both of their practices, particularly for the neurosurgeons who do a lot of really, really difficult trauma and brain surgery, that, you know, I admire these surgeons terrifically. They go through years and years of training, and they're highly skilled. But and so spine surgery becomes kind of the way they can make a pretty good income. Not that any of them are suffering. So I think that's led to some of the I don't want to call it abuse, but the high bills that we see and the attempts to have two surgeons in a room. There's a relative glut in New York, and meanwhile, you know, people are being a little more careful about prescribing back surgery. There's been a lot of publicity about the fact that in many cases it doesn't help.
Yes.
So I think there's probably less business, more surgeons, and, you know, it's a market. People look for ways to keep their income going. And I don't think it's always an evil motivation. I think, you know, at some level, we used to say when I was in medical school, you know, if you go to Midas, you get a muffler. And that means that if you train in something, if you train in neurosurgery, you train in orthopedics, you believe in the procedures you do, even perhaps over-believe in them when it's not totally necessary. But that's the solution that you tend to go to.
We're talking with Elizabeth Rosenthal this hour. She has another in her series, very well done, Pain Till It Hurts. It's in the New York Times. This one appeared last Sunday, and we're taking phone calls for her. Our lines are jammed, but, you know, keep the number in mind. Somebody will say goodbye in a minute, and you can say hello. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Elizabeth Rosenthal has written for The Times for a number of years. She's also, I find it very interesting, a trained medical doctor and has been doing this series on healthcare costs for The Times this year. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Julian in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I had two quick points to make. My statement isn't completely unbiased. My wife is a OBGYN, but the majority of where these costs are coming from, with the exception of bad examples like where she's given, where there was, you know, physicians aiding and, you know, charging for their aid at astronomical rates, the majority of the cases is for that $10,000 bill that you get for your baby delivery. My wife, who does all of the care, makes $800. For the delivery that involves a C-section, my wife, who provides all the care, does the surgery, makes $1,200, and that's a $14,000 bill. It's the insurance companies and the hospitals that are making these costs. There are situations where there are doctors that are doing what's being talked about, but for the vast part, it's the buddy system between the insurance companies and the hospitals. I mean, from another point, my daughter, who has required a lot of care because she had many complications at birth, maybe in the past 3 years has totaled almost $2 million in medical bills.
Nice.
The physicians who provided that call, who provided that care, maybe walked away with $5,000 or $6,000. This is almost $2 million in billing to the insurance company. The problem is not the doctors. There are bad doctors out there, yes. There are unscrupulous doctors out there, yes. But that's less than 3%.
Elizabeth.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to divide up the good and the bad. You know, when I talk about different specialties, if I had to pick one that was undervalued, I would say it was OBGYN. OBGYNs tend to bill for an entire pregnancy, and they bill in they do largely bundled care, and they wake up in the middle of the night all throughout their practice. They have a very difficult but rewarding emotionally practice, but we undervalue OB care. You know, I think it's true. You're going to find that it varies a lot hospital to hospital and doctor to doctor. I will say that what we've seen, and just looking at the issue of new babies who need very intensive care, a number of hospitals, and it sounds like not the one you were at, but a number of hospitals now, the neonatologists are out of network. So those are charges that are billed directly to the patients. And I have had a number of complaints from people who went to an in-network hospital for delivery were happy to pay the OBGYN charge, and then discovered afterwards that they were getting bills for $50,000, $60,000 from out-of-network neonatologists who contracted with the hospital. Mm-hmm. So who would have thought? You know,
right.
I think it's really hard to say, you know, what proportion is bad and what proportion is good. And there are many, many wonderful physicians out there who are very frustrated by a system that too often rewards bad behavior, but not doctors who are just trying to do the right thing for their mm-hmm. patients and make a difference. But I think the answer is we have to figure out a system that doesn't reward egregious behaviors and refocuses to reward the kind of health care we want.
Yeah. Thank you so much for the call, Julian. Nate sends this message, email, why isn't it like contractors at a building? Once you get a quote for work, you don't pay for the whole crew if he brings others to the job site.
Yes. I mean, you know, our hospitals are much more like workshops where everyone comes in and, and does their thing and charges separately for it. In many countries, we mentioned in the article, in Australia, for example, there's a patient bill of rights that says patients have the right to be informed of costs ahead of time. You know, we have these elaborate patients' bills of rights about informed consent and being a, you know, but they don't address what for many people is the biggest stress of being hospitalized now, which is what's it going to cost me?
Yes.
How am I
mm-hmm.
going to pay for this? And I think we could do that. In some countries, when patients are paying for their surgery, I mean, France is mostly a state system, but if you're paying for your surgery, you get a contract with the orthopedist if you're having a hip replacement beforehand that says, this is what's going to happen, and this is what I'm going to charge you. And there are some centers in the U.S. that are beginning to do that, too, giving you a price up front. But they are far and away the exception, and they generally don't take insurance. They generally want cash if they're doing that.
Tom in Stoughton, hi.
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 Well, what a pleasure to speak with you. I've been following your articles in the Times, and particularly your one regarding colonoscopies, because due to family histories, my wife and I both need them on a five-year basis.
Uh-huh.
And when we had our first one done 10 years ago, it was about $2,500. When we had the second one done 5 years ago, it was $5,000.
Yep.
I'm a small business owner, and I have to purchase my own insurance, so I have an HSA policy with a $10,000 deductible. Our colonoscopies, which we should be doing this year, are going to run us at least $10,000. So we're probably going to go abroad.
Yep.
And the problem we're having is we don't really know how to research that. How do you find a good physician who's going to provide you with competent care in a place where it's more affordable? I was wondering if you had any suggestions on that.
Well, you know, one of our patients, I mean, first of all, there's Canada. I have to say I don't know how to set that up. But many countries, including the UK and France and Belgium, where Michael Chopin, one of our earlier patients when he went to get a hip replacement, have both public and private systems. The private systems are still many times cheaper than care would be in the United States. And there are a number of companies now that will help you kind of research and go overseas for different kinds of procedures. So I'm afraid I can't be very helpful in terms of a specific recommendation, but more and more people are looking at that. And then there are also sites like Medibid, which is just one that will help people if they need a certain procedure. It's almost like medical tourism, but in the U.S. They'll tell you what if you have a very high deductible policy, they will tell you what different places are charging if you're going to be paying up front by yourself. And there are a lot of good deals on there. I mean, it's a little sad to me that people have to pay for important preventive care the way they would shop for, you know, toasters, but
right.
That's the way it is.
Yeah. Well, I hope you at least get a good vacation before the colonoscopy. Pick the country, right, Tom?
I was hoping Thailand or Costa Rica.
There you go. They could have a little fun, too. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Susan in Madison. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm a healthcare attorney, and I negotiate the contracts between physicians and insurance companies to get reimbursed. And I can tell you that this drive-by consult, the CPT code requires in order to charge for a consult that there has to be a written request from the attending physician. So if these people are, you know, are coming in and doing these consults without getting that written request from the attending physician, that is a fraudulent bill, and you should not be paying it. You know, you should turn them in because that is not billable.
Elizabeth.
Yeah, I think, well, two things I would say. First of all, in some cases, what I've seen is it's the hospital who's actually kind of doing a blanket requisition saying, okay, we want every patient who's hospitalized here to get a daily look-see from a hospitalist, whether that's a person who would normally need that or not. Or, you know, we mentioned some hospitals say everyone needs a physical therapy consult before they're discharged. Really? You know, is that necessary? Or everyone needs an occupational therapy consult before discharge. So that's one thing. I think it's sometimes a kind of blanket consult. The way we see with a lot of the use of electronic medical records, where every time someone gets an X-ray, there'll be a box check saying recommend follow-up CT unless you uncheck that box. So I think there's a lot of room for mass ordering of consults and procedures the way we do things today. The second thing is, and this becomes a problem, is that maybe it's fraudulent billing, but it's really hard for any one patient to know that, and it's very hard, from what I hear from insurers, for them to invest the time to look into that, unless they see a pattern of abuse. Like if they see a certain doctor is always ordering, you know, having the same assistant come in who's out of network, then they might go after that doctor. But the problem is, you know, it's tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, of little abuses, and maybe you see a consult for $400 and someone you don't remember. How many people have the energy to fight that?
Right.
I think that's the problem mm-hmm. that we're up against, and why people do this, because they know, you know, they most likely can.
Mm-hmm. Susan, thanks so much for your call. Bev in Central Wisconsin. Bev?
Yes.
Go right ahead. Are you there?
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
We're here.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
I have a different point of view on this drive-by doctor. I had a total knee replacement back in 97, and I wasn't told that there was no plastic disc put behind my kneecap. And within 2 months, my kneecap was broken.
Ooh.
And the leg became unstable. And within 2 or 3 years, I slipped on the ice, fell, and broke my ankle. And the doctor who was doing the so-called repair surgeries had to work on it about 4 or 5 different surgeries, and not a one of them was successful. I now have a deformed foot and a knee that is unstable. And I think drive-by doctors in some cases should be there, because it didn't work for me.
Elizabeth.
Well, I think if what you're saying is there should have been an assistant in the room and a better surgery done the first time, yes. And I think, you know, that's the individual doctor's judgment, whether he or she needed an assistant surgeon. And my issue really isn't whether you need an assistant or not. You know, if my doctor says, you know what, this gallbladder surgery is getting more complicated, I want to call someone in, I don't have a problem with that. I think that, of course, you need to allow for that. But you really don't want the guy who's coming in or the woman who's coming in billing, 100 times more what would be considered a reasonable rate.
Right.
It's not a license it's not a license to push the cash register keys and charge whatever you want.
Right. And thank you so much. Another terrific article. You must feel good about this, Elizabeth. You're just doing such important work here.
Well, as you can tell, I enjoy talking about this.
Yeah, well, you should. And we enjoy having you. Thanks. Until
thank
the next
you.
Time.
Yes, thank
thanks.
You.
Thanks. Elizabeth Rosenthal, her series is Paying Till It Hurts. We were talking about last Sunday's front page story in the New York Times, which is on our Facebook page in case you missed it and would like to find it. Then you could go to the Kathleen Dem Show. Elizabeth is a medical doctor as well, and her series has been extremely important. A lot of people should be doing series like this because of the cost of health care in this country. Well, thank you to KP Whaley, who also does terrific work for producing this hour, and thanks to KP for doing on-air production as well in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We're going to be talking about ISIS and these new groups we're bombing now, the first hour of the program, and four women who became spies during the Civil War, hour two of Thursday's shows.